So this is continuing with John Shakeshaft on 26th August 76. You said you were involved with the 3C, which went for a couple of years after the Paris meeting and this analysis.
That's right. And but by then the preliminary paper on the 4C was coming along, and the paper by Pat Foster, Pat Leslie, as she then was, and who else did it? Paul Scott, was he involved?
I think so. Right. Yeah.
So that was coming along. They're just the first results at that time, and again, of course, this was confirmation of the steepness of the source counts.
Now, what would you say was really the philosophy of doing the 4C survey?
Well, it was to get again to really clear up this. Convince the rest of the world that we were right about the source counts, but also, of course, to measure positions accurately, to get identifications by that time, also to measure angular diameters, and to be able to clarify the arguments of people that we were overlooking lots of large diameter sources, which would give us an apparent hole and fewer intense sources. So it was really to tidy up the whole situation.
Were people arguing that, well, sure, 3C showed a steeper slope than 1.5, but there weren't enough sources in it to really make that significant, so you needed to get more sources? Is that?
Well, partly that, yes. It was just to do the whole thing better and more thoroughly.
But now, to get identifications, what were the accuracies of the 4C survey?
Oh, about difficult to think back to those times, isn't it? About 20 seconds of arc in right extension, I think, and about 2 minutes of arc in declination.
I don't know.
Something like that.
That sounds about right.
Yes.
I can't really remember now. You probably can. Did it lead to a lot of identifications, the 4C survey?
Yes. Yes, a considerable number.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for example, Derek Wills. I mean, that's where he got
his interest in
this side of it. I mean, he was involved with the 4C survey and with the identifications, and I mean, he went right through the Abel clusters, for example, and published a paper on those comparisons. I mean, a paper which is often now forgotten. But he did some of the original, he identified sources in some of those originally.
Well, it seems to me that 3C really is, the identifications of 3C were the ones that really became critical. That with those you had enough, to really begin understanding a little bit about what radio sources are, at least as much as we do understand.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Well, I mean, by that time...
This is hindsight again.
Oh, yes, by that time one knew... Well, I mean, Ryle's arguments in the Bakerian lecture, in the Halley lecture, I forget which came first, but...
Well, Halley was 55, that was well earlier.
It must have been the Bakerian then, 57. Yeah. The Bakerian lecture, I mean, that we were convinced that, most sources were extragalactic, and, I mean, as I say, I can't now remember just what proportion we thought would ever get identified, Well, we were by then quite convinced that most of them were extragalactic.
Oh yeah,
and that has never shifted.
No, I know that wasn't quite my point. What I'm saying is, that in retrospect, is it, you think it's fair to say that the sample of 400 sources, the 400 strongest, given by 3C, was really enough one had enough to deal with there. That one didn't need to go to a few thousand sources to understand identification.
Oh, for identification.
Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Of course, still the 3C sources are the ones that people have worked on optically, and still they're not fully worked on. And this has been, in my view, the optical astronomers really have been a bit remiss in that only just now. I mean, despite quite a lot of effort in the early 60s, trying to persuade Martin Schmidt and Anna Sandage and others, and Margaret Burbidge, to work on the 3C sources. Mm-hmm. It's only just now that you know, people have realized the importance of this. I mean, yeah. we've been working, I mean, we've been working for many years on really getting information about a complete sample so that we could do statistics and all. But only now has High Spin Red and Christian and the others really realized this. I mean,
in the last 3 or 4 years, you're saying.
Quite recently, right. Well, it's not quite true. I mean, Alan Sandage and Christian have been working on it, but not really as in the manner that I think would have been profitable. Of course, I mean, it was the advent of the quasars that sidetracked them all, and so that really people have been. I mean, it's difficult to say at this stage whether. You know, which was the right policy, but I mean, the quasars were undoubtedly more glamorous, and people were trying to get bigger and better redshifts. And
the sidetrack—that's rather interesting to say that. I'm as a devil's advocate, I would say that the quasars stimulated so much interest that, sure, a lot of work was done on them, but also probably more than would have been done otherwise was done on the radio galaxies.
Yes, you may well be right. Yes, but no, I mean that's I think you're. I think that's probably right. That. I mean, I can remember Alan Sandage saying to me sometime, when would this be? Probably about 65, probably at the second Texas Symposium. Was that 64 maybe? 60, when was that? It was 64, wasn't it?
About then, yes.
Yeah,
I'm not sure
exactly. I think, at Austin. I mean, he's saying to me, you know, sort of in sort of wonderment almost, you know, sort of what an incredible transformation of the scene radio astronomy had made, the extragalactic scene.
Yeah.
And, well, so it had, of course, and so it has.
Did you have any idea as you were working with the 3C that it was sort of going to become the standard survey as it has? You know, that people would be talking about 3C such and such.
Well.
They probably will be for the next 100 years. So.
Well, not... Well,
I mean, NGC of radio sources is what it's turned out to be.
One doesn't quite think in those terms, but I mean, having fouled up 2C, wanted to be absolutely certain that 3C was right, so that one was very cautious about that.
Yeah. I must ask you, it's been several times in this interview where you've talked about. For instance, the Paris Symposium, the group went on the defensive, and there's a very strong feeling of the group at Cambridge.
That's right.
And I'd just be interested in your feelings as to how this develops.
I think probably, well, almost certainly, by Martin Ryle's personality, and he inspires great affection and loyalty, despite, in the early days, you know, difficult situations and so on, but so that one always felt a great loyalty to him personally.
Yeah.
And so I think that he was he has been the person who has, who's made it so cohesive a group as it has been. I mean, you've only got to look at the fact that most of us have been, you know, working together for so many years To see this.
Well, it's incredible. I mean, there are other examples of a lot of people working together for years, but usually a stasis sets in. It's my observation after 15 years or so, but in my humble opinion, that hasn't happened at Cambridge.
Well, it's nice of you to say so.
So what I'm saying is that such a quality is not necessarily desirable, but in this case, it has worked.
No, I mean, we have obviously been very worried at times, you know, as to whether getting too inbred.
Yeah.
But there have been, of course, there has been continual flow of new blood, and we've been very fortunate in having some extremely good students coming along, and so who brought their own, own ideas in and their own stimulus, so that we have been, I think, kept fairly fresh.
Along this line, let me ask you about the Saturday morning sessions, which you essentially organized. Was it your idea originally?
No, I think not. The literature discussions, you mean? No, this was something that initiated, but I mean, when I arrived in the group, or at some stage, anyway, before we started it was being done by the ionospheric people in the group with Ratcliffe.
I see.
So that, I mean, it was may have been started by Ratcliffe. I don't know. He would be the person to ask about that. But it was. I mean, we took it over from them, really.
I see. And do you see these as? It seems to me that from talking with people that these have been rather important over the years. And
I think they were. Alas, now they've they're not effective anymore for many good reasons, bad reasons. But they're not effective. But I think they also were very important. Yes, in fostering this cohesive group cohesion.
Yeah, sort of the one time a week when everyone was there and
exchange views and well, of course, and also I mean, I know we've been much criticised for sticking together and for taking the same line on problems. But mm-hmm. I mean, this is largely, I think, oh, I'm sure, is largely because, I mean, these problems were hammered out jointly, and mm-hmm. so that we saw things the same way. I mean, if there were good arguments for believing a particular thing, I mean, it was because we'd all seen the force of these arguments and hammered them out, and so that we did think the same way about things.
Yeah. I'd be interested in, obviously the radio astronomy has changed very much. Sort of early 60s when it becomes a sort of big science, you must have a big... And I'd be interested in why you think that a Saturday morning session doesn't work. Is that related to this?
I don't say it couldn't work in certain circumstances, in a smaller group.
In your case, why?
Well, it's not working in our case, for various reasons. One is that the students... objected to coming in on Saturday mornings.
Okay, those are very fundamental.
I mean, this still happens. You find most of the staff there on a Saturday morning getting their paperwork done and getting on with some research, but very few students, by and large.
I see.
So that was one reason, and they were just going away for the weekend and not turning up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one reason. So it was moved to another afternoon in the week, and that was I think that was really the crucial death blow, because we still try to run these discussions, mind you, but they're just not very successful anymore, because I mean, by and large, Saturday morning was clear of teaching, and so most people could get there, you know, and they made the effort and they enjoyed it and they exchanged views and everything. But now if you move it to another day, I mean, someone's bound to be have a teaching commitment or a committee meeting or this and that and the other, you know, and so it's just not the same. No, you don't get everybody there at one time. That's the trouble.
I was wondering if maybe the huge size of the field is also a bit
that's
crippling.
That's another factor. Also, the huge size of our group is another factor. Also, another important reason which I worry about quite a lot, important thing which I worry about quite a lot, is that we've each of us now got sort of other, we've grown older and more senior and got other commitments, I mean university commitments, in my case with the Royal Astronomical Society, which means, you know, I have to be in London and committee meetings and this sort of thing. And whereas, you know, 20 years ago, one could, sort of everyone in the group was, just spending full time on research pretty well. I mean, of course, Martin Weil, virtually never had any serious teaching commitments. I mean, he was recognized as a researcher right from the start,
right.
And was kept. So he virtually has been able to give all his time to research.
Well, I was going to mention that as a possibility. You brought it up. Is that another difference, perhaps, was it wasn't that much difference, 10 years at most, between the age of the research students and the age of the staff.
That, of course,
and
was,
so you
yes,
were
indeed,
you were
yes.
much more yes. willing to
yes.
agree on when you would meet and things like this.
Yes.
Whereas now the gap is
well, of course,
inevitably
indeed, yes. Well, this is another
increasing.
Thing that the generation gap that one worries about. And I mean, this, of course, I'm not going to say anything original now, but this is very worrying for, I mean, the current economic situation, and the fact that, that there will be, you know, a real generation gap. I mean, is very worrying for anyone sort of responsible for leading research.
Yeah, right.
And, I mean, this is in the scientific discussed in the scientific press all over.
Well, that pretty much covers the specific papers. Did you have anything else you'd like to say as you look back over radio astronomy as you've been involved with it?
Oh, I don't know.
This is your chance.
Well, I'm sure I have lots of comments to make on your the draft, if I ever
okay.
get to see one.
Well, there will be a draft. Thank you.
That ends the interview with John Shakeshaft on 26 August 76.